This episode of the JomoCast is sponsored by Freedom. Freedom is an easy-to-use app that allows you to block distractions in sync across all of your devices to work and live distraction-free. Welcome to the JomoCast. I'm your host, Christina Crook. Join us as we sit down with leading founders, creators, and thought leaders to learn how they embrace the joy of missing out. These guests are choosing to digitally detox and usher balance into their busy lives. Let's dive right in. Nuriel writes, consults, and teaches about the intersection of psychology, technology, and business. Nir previously taught as a lecturer in marketing at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford. Nir co-founded and sold two tech companies since 2003 and was dubbed by the MIT Technology Review as the prophet of habit-forming technology. He authored two best-selling books, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and the more recent, Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. Nir is also an active investor in habit-forming technologies. Some of his past investments included Eventbrite, Anchor.fm, which was acquired by Spotify, Marco Polo, and more. He attended the Stanford Graduate School of Business and Emory University. It is my great pleasure to introduce you to Nir Eyal. Well, Nir, thank you so much for being with me today. This is the JomoCast, and I wanted to start off our conversation today by asking you, what does the joy of missing out mean to you?
So the joy of missing out is about living your life according to your values. I'm very big on values. And if I'm honest with you, before I started this line of research that led to publishing my book, Indistractable, I didn't actually really understand what values were. If you asked me, okay, what are values? And values are, if you would have said, are values important to you? I would have said, yes, values are very important to me. But what are values? I don't really know. But now I do know. My definition of values are attributes of the person I want to become. Those are my values, attributes of the person I want to become. And so when it comes to the joy of missing out, I think that it's really about living according to what you say is an attribute of the person you want to become without the influence of what other people want you to do with your time, what other people want you to do with your attention, what other people want you to do with your life. It's about taking the joy, the pleasure in living your life on your terms, controlling your attention, therefore controlling your time and your life.
I love it. Amazing answer. So you've already referenced Indistractable. We know you're the author of Hooked and Indistractable. We heard that in the intro today, but could you tell us more about your work and particularly what do you love about what you do?
Oh man, I really love my job now. This is the first job I've ever really liked, to be honest. I've started a couple companies. I worked as a consultant. I've had a lot of jobs in my life. And this is the first one I really love. And I finally found what I want to do for the rest of my life. And the reason I love it so much is because, you know, as a fellow author, my good friend Gretchen Rubin, maybe you've read some of her books, Happiness Project. She's written several books now. But she told me once that research is me search. That what I love about my job is that I get to come up with interesting questions and answer them for myself. And that's why I write books. And that's why I do my research, is because I got a problem. And for most of my problems in life, I'll talk about them with my wife. I'll write about them. I'll think about them. I'll process them. If I still don't get a satisfactory answer, I'll go read somebody else's book on it. And most of the time, somebody else has done research that gives me my answer. But then once in a while, about every 5 years or so has been my cadence, there will be a problem that I read the experts' books on, and none of them fix my problem. And my problem a few years ago was distraction. I've never been good about self-control. I've never been good about willpower. And even like saying those words still gives me like makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up, because I used to be clinically obese. I remember hearing my grandmother and my mother tell me about how like I should just have more self-control and you know, stop eating so much. And I just hated it. Like it was just such a terrible thing. And I think that, you know, overcoming these behaviors that I felt like controlled me, whether it was food and then more recently, all kinds of distractions, particularly in the form of the technology that I used in to a harmful extent. Because I get to research this, I read all the other books on the topic about distraction, and all the other books on the topic basically said, like, it's the technology's fault, right? It's all Facebook's fault. It's all the big tech company's fault. Stop using technology, right? Another professor in some ivory tower saying, well, just stop using your cell phone so much. Thanks, stupid. Like, I can't do that. I have a job. And I have a family that lives thousands of miles away that I want to stay connected with. So that doesn't work for me. And even when I took the advice, okay, so I said, you know what? I'm just going to try it. I'm going to try one of these digital detoxes. And I got myself a flip phone. I bought it online on Alibaba for $12, like straight from China, this like flip phone like we used to have in the 1990s. And I got myself a word processor from this library in like middle of Wisconsin on eBay. They were selling these 1990s word processors with no internet connection. All you could do is type on it. And I said, okay, I'm going to follow their advice. Like, nothing's going to distract me, right? I've got this old technology with no internet, you know, no apps. And I would sit down and I would say, okay, now I'm going to write. But you know what? There's that book that I've been meaning to finish. Let me just check that out, because there's probably some good research in that book. Or let me just tidy up my desk, or let me just clean up. You know, I need to take out the trash, or the laundry. I got to go do the laundry. And I would still get distracted, even without the technology.
It's snack time. We need a snack.
It's snack time. Yeah. Oh, you know what? I need to make a pour over coffee right now, because then I'll be able to.
It's very important.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so what I discovered was that distraction is a much deeper and I think more interesting problem than just the tools that distract us. Because people have been blaming the tools forever, right? If you look at, like, you know, historically, people blame the television and the radio and the comic books. And it's like literally the same words that people use today to talk about how, you know, video games and Facebook are melting your brain. It's the same exact words people said about the latest moral panic, you know, the one before. And so that can't be the source of the problem. I wanted to go much deeper to figure out really why I was getting distracted.
Awesome. So let's talk about the book. Let's talk about habits. So you referenced some of the challenges that you've personally sought to overcome and have overcome. What's been the hardest bad habit for you to break? What behavioral change projects have you embarked on personally, and how did they go?
Well, I will say lately, so first of all, becoming indistractable, so the title of the book, doesn't mean you never get distracted, okay? I still get distracted from time to time, but I think the difference is a distractible person lets the same thing distract them again and again and again, right? Paulo Coelho has a wonderful quote. He says, a mistake repeated more than once is a decision. A mistake repeated more than once is a decision. And so distractible people, like I used to be, decided to be distractible. We let ourselves get distracted by the same thing again and again. Well, now I am indistractable. An indistractable person strives to do what they say they're going to do. They are as honest with themselves as they are with other people. And I find that most people are very honest with others. You know, we never want to be called a liar. That's a terrible thing to be called. We would never lie to the people we love or our friends or, you know, our colleagues. We would never lie to others, but we lie to ourselves all the time, right? I would say I was going to work out. I didn't. I would say I was going to eat right. I'll start tomorrow. I would say I was going to work on that big project. Okay, it can wait. And I would keep lying to myself all the time. And that's why I was a distracted person. Whereas now, because I'm indistractable, I know why I got distracted, and I can take steps today to make sure I don't get distracted tomorrow. But when things change, so you asked, what did I struggle with the most? When things change, there are surprises, right? So you can get distracted once, right? If it's not a repeated thing, then you don't have the defenses yet to defend against it. You don't know why you got distracted. So when Corona hit, you know, I thought the world was distracting before Corona. And then all of a sudden we have all these new distractions. So my biggest challenge was the news, right? That I would check the news thinking, well, it's my civic duty to stay up to date on every political this and that. It's, you know, I have to keep up to date with what's happening every day. Like, I should be an armchair epidemiologist to make sure that I'm prepared to fight the virus. But if I'm really honest with you, it was a way to deal with my anxiety. It was a way to deal with my fear. I wasn't solving the problem by worrying about something 1,000 miles away. right? I can't do anything about 99% of what's in the news. I was doing it to escape. I was doing it to alleviate my discomfort of uncertainty and fear and stress. But of course, the news was just making things worse. I was getting more stressed, more anxious, more uncertain. And frankly, this is the same reason I was obese, right? It's that same spiral of, I wasn't eating because food was delicious, right? That was literally the icing on the cake, so to speak. The real reason I was overeating was because I was eating when I felt stressed. I was eating when I felt lonely. I was eating when I felt shame for eating too much. That's why I was doing things I didn't want to do. And so it's the same with all distractions, whether it's too much food, too much Facebook, too much news, too much booze, it doesn't matter. It's all about this fundamental understanding of impulse control, of this problem of doing something that is not what you said you would do, is always an impulse control issue. It is not a character flaw. There's nothing wrong with you. It's simply that we haven't learned the tools to get out of our own way so that we can do what we really want to do in life.
I love it. How did you get out of that news cycle? Was that the first step, was becoming aware that it was just feeding your anxiety? And then how did you stop?
So I told my wife, when Corona erupted, I said, you know, Indistractable came out late last year, late 2019. And I told her, I said, thank God I wrote this book because I would be a hot mess right now because I had to take my own medicine, right? Like when I saw that this wasn't making me happy, I was spending more time than I wanted on these silly distractions to comfort myself. I took out the book and I literally reread it. I literally started following the advice that had taken me 5 years to write. And I still reference it from time to time because, you know, there are 30 pages of citations of peer-reviewed studies. And I really wanted to get, you know, I didn't want just, you know, I hate these business books or personal advice books that's like, hey, here's what worked for me, so it's going to work for everybody. Meh, that's not good enough. Like, I really want to see, when I read a book, it's nice to hear anecdotes, but I really want to see the peer-reviewed studies, right? Like, I am a man of science. I want to see the publication that it was reviewed by other academics, you know, like the replicated studies. And so that's why it was really important for me to understand the science behind why I got distracted. And so I just followed my four strategies that I talk about in the book. So step number one is mastering the internal triggers. So that has to be the first step. And there's all kinds of strategies for how to do that. The second step is to make time for traction. What's happened, I think, in this age of people working from home is that for many people, their schedules have been obliterated, right? That it turns out that getting up at a certain time of day to wake up the kids and get them fed and get them to school and getting stuck in traffic, but then getting to work and having lunch meetings, all of that stuff provides us with a certain amount of structure that suddenly has evaporated from people's lives. And that's had some really deleterious consequences. In fact, Google has reported that there's been this exponential spike in people searching for the term, what day is it? Okay. People literally type into Google, what day is it? Because they can't remember. Like, they've lost all track of time.
One long March break.
Exactly. Exactly. It's maddening, literally. And so what we have to do is to reimpose that schedule. And this was part of my solution, was having that strict schedule that kind of got obliterated during, you know, all the madness that ensued. So going back to having a what we call a time box schedule was very, very important. And then step number three is about hacking back the external triggers, right? Taking the steps to make sure you don't have all those pings and dings interrupting you and leading you towards distraction rather than the things you want to do, the acts of traction in your life. And then finally, the fourth step is to prevent distraction with pacts. And this is where we make promises to ourselves, to others, or ironically enough, use technology to block out technology distraction. So I use all kinds of tools. Many of them are absolutely free. Anyone can use them. They're free for the taking, to make sure that in a moment of weakness, when all I want to do is go, you know, check the New York Times or, you know, watch some news or whatever, that there are blocks in place as a firewall, as a last line of defense to make sure I don't get distracted. But it really is these four strategies, not only in concert, but also in order. You have to do them in order. Master internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, and prevent distraction with pacts.
In your opinion, if you could only name one, what is the worst tech habit that most people have?
TV.
Tell me more.
The average American, according to Nielsen, spends 5 hours a day on television. 5 hours!
And now, of course, TV encompasses like Amazon Prime and Netflix and all of that.
No, cable. This is not screen time. This is television time.
Cable.
It pales all other sites. If you think about, for example, Facebook and their filings, they say that the average user of all their products, so Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, the average user, I think, is around 50 minutes, 50. So TV is five times more than that. That is by far the biggest distraction. You know, when we talk about, you know, Facebook influencing the elections or, you know, manipulating people's brains or it's not even close, right? Like the effect that Fox News had dwarfs any kind of impact that you know, whatever your aunt spread rumors on Facebook or whatever it might be.
Wow. Yeah, it's so wild to think about. I've heard those stats before, but I think when I think about my peer group, and maybe you have the same experience, none of my friends are watching, right, traditional television. Mm. But is it the baby boomers that are just throwing that number way?
Probably. Could be. Could be. But it's the one thing I want to be careful of, because I'm kind of leading to, people may think that there's a conclusion here that I don't agree with, which is I don't think it's the technology itself. And that technology could be the television, the radio, the internet, it doesn't matter. Anything that you do with intent is fine, right? So I'm not one of these Chicken Little tech critics that says technology is distracting and it's hijacking your brain and it's addicting you. That is just not true. That's bunk. If you plan to use it on your schedule, what you are doing is essentially taking a distraction and turning it into traction by using forethought. So now I have time in my schedule to check Facebook. I have time for Twitter. I have time for LinkedIn. It's in my schedule. And so if what you want to do with your time, back to your values, if one of your attributes of the person you want to become is, yeah, I want to interact with people online, great, do it, enjoy it, and do it without guilt, but do it on your schedule and with forethought, not when you feel lonely, bored, indecisive, stressed, anxious to escape reality, but do it thoughtfully because that's something that is part of your value system. It's part of the attributes of the person you want to become.
I like that a lot. Okay, I would like to talk a little bit about your first book, Hooked, and how it relates to your new mission in life. So your book, Indistractable, is written for the individual trying to change their behavior, but most of your prior work advises brands on how to make their products and experiences more habit-forming.
Right.
Is it possible that someone now needs your help breaking out of the excessive use of a product whose brand has followed your other advice?
I doubt it. At least I've never worked with a company. So first of all, there's certain... Okay, let me explain why I wrote Hooked in the first place. So I wrote Hooked. I published it in 2014. And I wrote it to steal the secrets from the big tech companies, right? I wanted to democratize their techniques because they already know these techniques, right? Facebook and Instagram and... Amazon and the gaming companies, they've known these techniques for years. They don't need my book. That's where I learned these things. I talk to people on the inside to learn how they do it. The idea was, what if all sorts of businesses could use the same psychology that makes these products so sticky, so engaging, so habit-forming to build healthy habits? So companies like Kahoot, the world's largest educational software company, they called me up shortly after I published the book, and the CEO, Johan, called me and said, hey, look, I have this idea for a business. I'm using your Hook model. What do you think? And I said, oh my God, this is incredible. I love it. And I invested in the company, and today they're worth over $1 billion. They just went public in October, and they are getting kids hooked onto online learning. I love it. I think that's a wonderful application of how we can build good habits in people's lives. Fitbod, another app that uses the Hook model, gets people hooked to exercise. In fact, the only case study in the book is not some social media company. It's not some video game business. The only case study in Hooked is the Bible. The Bible app. It's one of the most widely used apps in the world. It would certainly be a multi-billion-dollar company if it was publicly traded, but it's not. It's owned by a church. And it turns out that the Bible app uses the Hook model. And many people are surprised by that because they think, oh, it kind of sounds like an ominous title, and they only think about, you know, the bad applications of technology. But what you think about the Bible will tell you a lot about what you think about the application of these techniques. Because if you think religion is a force for good, that it brings people together, that it gives them a moral calling, that it gives them purpose in life, well, you're all for using behavioral design tactics that I described to help people engage with scripture. But if you're someone who believes that religion is a force for divisiveness, that it pulls people apart, that it separates us on sectarian grounds, then you think that using the Bible app, using behavioral design to get people to use the Bible app is a terrible idea. And so what I was trying to do was to kind of, I didn't call this out explicitly, but I'll tell it to you now. I didn't want to make a case study out of Facebook or some video game company. I wanted to make it out of the Bible app because if you were to ask, well, is the Bible app good? Is it bad? The answer is yes to both.
It comes back you know? To your values again, right?
That's it depends, the values. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's back to your values. Exactly. Is Facebook good or bad? Yes, both. Right? It depends again on your values. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to show that it's not about these techniques. It's about how these products are used that really makes the difference. And so that's why I wrote that book in the first place. And to date, it's, you know, I do have some rules around companies that I will not work with. So okay. I don't work with any companies that prey on children, for example, because children are a protected class of people, right? There are laws that protect children from doing things they're not ready to do because they don't have sound mind and bodies. My daughter is 12 years old. She can't walk into a bar and order a gin and tonic. She can't, you know, saunter into a casino and play blackjack. She's not ready for it. So anybody who you know, caters to children, I don't work with. I won't work with any companies that knowingly pursue people who are pathologically addicted. So okay. I won't work with tobacco. I won't work with casinos. I won't work with pornography companies because those businesses depend on people who are pathologically addicted to stay in business. But for you know, the companies that use my book Hooked, it's healthcare companies that people want to use a medical device, but they keep forgetting to use it. You know, that's the kind of product that might use the Hook model, or of course, education, or those type of products.
So last question on this topic, related specifically to habits, is there a use case for a brand making their product or experience less habit forming? And related to that, is it by definition always better for a brand to maximize the amount of space they occupy in a consumer's minds or not?
Well, I think if it's too much, you would hear about it. So if it's a burden, you would know that. So part of the Hook model, there are four steps to the Hook model, kind of like the Indistractable model. There's also four steps. I'm partial to four-step models, apparently. So there are four steps in the Hook model. And so you have the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment. And one thing that's very, very important to realize is that if the product fundamentally, the reward has to scratch the user's itch. There has to be a connection there. So if the product is not rewarding, if it is not giving the user what they want, if it is not alleviating the pain point they came to solve with your product, they're not going to keep using it. People are not puppets on a string. You can't manipulate them any which way you want. They have to use the product because it benefits them in some way. So typically, if a product is taking up too much space in someone's life, people aren't stupid. They say, oh, gosh, this product is too engaging. It's too much. I don't need it this much. Like, why does it keep bothering me? And they will disconnect from it. They'll find an alternative. They'll turn it off. They'll switch off notifications. They'll find something that serves them better. And so, you know, everything in Hooked, it's not mind control. It's about building the kind of products that people use because they want to, not because they have to.
Right. Is the itch that social media is solving human connection?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so.
So much to talk about. We'll just leave it at that for now. I think we'll circle back. I want to talk a bit about children and parenting as it relates to your topic. So you talk on your blog and in speaking events that you do not believe that screen time and social media use are the root causes of youth issues today. And in fact, observe that a moral panic, we've already talked about this a little bit, has accompanied every society changing technology. Do you believe that children today are broadly no more emotionally unhealthy than their ancestors?
I think the opposite. I think they are more emotionally healthy than past generations. If you look, in fact, at the 1980s, this, you know, we talked about, you hear every day how the suicide rate is so high today. Well, it is high from a multi-year low around 2008. But if you go back further, the 1980s saw much higher suicide rates in children than we see today. Why? We don't know. And there's no good conclusion around that. We also know, you know, people who say, oh, social media is causing an increase in suicide and depression symptoms. Well, if that was true, wouldn't you expect that to happen wherever we find cell phones and social media, right? That would make sense. Like if you introduce a factor, you know, let's say like, you know, during the thalidomide crisis, you know, there was this drug that when pregnant women took this drug, their children had birth defects. And everywhere that that there was thalidomide, children were born with birth defects. Okay, well, that's a very, there's a lot of evidence for a causal relationship there that thalidomide caused birth defects. Well, wouldn't we see something similar if we can make a claim here around causation? You would think everywhere that children are using cell phones and social media, you would see an increase in depression, anxiety, and suicide. That ain't happening. Not only is it not happening internationally, it's only happening, it turns out, in North America and the UK. Japan has higher rates of children using technology, higher cell phone penetration rates. The Nordic countries, higher cell phone penetration rates. In fact, all the other OECD countries, except for US, Canada, and UK, all other OECD countries have seen the decline of teen suicide since 2008, not the increase like we see in those three countries, the US, Canada, and the UK. We don't know why. Furthermore, even if you look at the US, you would think that where you see higher cell phone penetration, if cell phones apparently are causing suicide, you would expect to see wherever there's higher cell phone penetration, higher rates of suicide. Not true, even in the United States. The highest rates of cell phone usage is in urban areas. Urban children tend to use cell phones more, and more of them use it, than in rural areas. But the number of suicides that is occurring in the United States is, among teens, has been flat in urban areas since 2008. Almost all of the increase in teen suicide comes from rural areas, right? Comes from Trump country, to be honest. That's where we're seeing this increase in suicide. So clearly there's something else going on. The correlation, I think, is quite spurious to say that this is somehow caused by technology. Now, we do not need to have a techno panic to find ways to use technology in a more responsible manner than we use it today with our children. I cannot stand when I go to a restaurant and I see people giving their kids. Yeah, it drives me crazy. Whoever told people that iPads are iNannies? Where does that say that on the box? Steve Jobs never said, hey, parents, want to stop being a parent? Give your kid a device to shut them up. That's not the technology doing it. That's a tool that I think is misapplied. And I think something very similar would happen if we said, okay, kids, read your comic books at the dinner table. No, we need conversation. We want to interact with each other. And whether it's a comic book or Harry Potter or an iPad, you know, any form of media that is taking away from something as precious as time with your family, that's not a technology problem. I think that's a parenting problem, frankly.
I'd like to tell you about a wonderful tool developed by a supporter of the JomoCast. We've talked a lot about how social media and mobile apps are designed on purpose to be habit-forming, distracting, and to let us thoughtlessly lose hours of our day. Part of cultivating intentional tech use means taking control back from influences like this and not letting them get in the way of what really matters. The Freedom app works across all your devices at once, Mac, Android, anything you've got, freeing you from the distractions that you choose. You can block time-wasting sites and apps or the entire internet for a deeply productive, focused session. Freedom gives you complete control of how much help you need and when. With a premium Freedom subscription, you can schedule daily or weekly sessions across specific sites, apps, and devices. Freedom users report regaining about 2.5 hours of productive time every single day. Wow. Because I believe in never advocating something I don't value myself, I've been using Freedom and had a wonderful first experience with it. After choosing to block all distracting apps, I later tried opening Facebook and got the message, "You are free. Do what matters. I can't think of any purer expression of JOMO than that. Give freedom a try with a special JOMOcast discount. Install and upgrade to a premium yearly or forever plan for 40% off with code JOMO, J-O-M-O. Find out more at freedom.to/JOMO. That's freedom.to/JOMO. I encourage you to give freedom a try. So you've written and spoken numerous times about how you strive for healthy tech habits with your daughter, who you mentioned a little bit earlier. You said she's 12.
Yeah.
Amazing. I've got an 11-year-old daughter.
Okay.
In your view, what do you think is the most important strategy or intervention that parents are missing? You kind of talked about it already a little bit. I would love to hear a little bit about, you know, what parameters you do have for your daughter, if any.
Sure. Okay. So let me start with the most important piece of advice.
Great.
And I'm hesitant because parents aren't going to like it, but I'm going to say it anyway, because we parents sometimes need tough love too, which is we as parents need to stop being hypocrites. You cannot tell your child to stop playing Fortnite while you're checking Facebook. Doesn't work that way. Okay. We have to become indistractable ourselves. And it's perfectly okay to be vulnerable with your children and to tell them, look, I am struggling as well. There are some very smart people out there making these products in such a way that makes these products very engaging, that makes me want to check them. Just like when I'm nervous about what's happening in the world, daddy really wants to turn on the news on TV, right? Or when I've had a really hard day at work, I really want to watch some football to take my mind off my problems, right? It's all from that same source. And I think talking about this dilemma, I think many parents think, oh, I'm not allowed to show any weakness to my kids. I can't let them know I'm struggling. And I think it's quite the opposite. That when children see that you are making an effort, that you are struggling with this, I think that creates greater empathy and it makes us part of the same team. Hmm. And then what we're going to do is we're going to walk through these very same four steps, the same four steps that you walk through to become indistractable. We help our children walk through as well, mastering the internal triggers. So children's internal triggers are very different from adults' internal triggers. And there's a whole section in the book about how to raise indistractable kids, where I dive into what I call psychological nutrients that, physiologically, we know that there are these three macronutrients, protein, carbohydrates, and fat, the three macronutrients that we all need to survive. And psychologically, it turns out there's some 40-year-old research, this is called self-determination theory, that says that there are these three psychological nutrients of competency, autonomy, and relatedness, that we all need these things. But if you look at children's lives today, they are sorely deficient in these three psychological nutrients of competency, autonomy, and relatedness. And so when there's this theory called the needs displacement hypothesis that says, if you don't get what you're looking for offline, if you're not getting your psychological nutrients met in the real world, you go looking for them in the online world. And I think that tends to happen with many children today who overdo technology. Mm. And so we need to talk about those internal triggers and figure out where are our children deficient and fix those deficiencies. And many times it's something simple as, you know, look, will my daughter ask to watch a show on Netflix? Yeah. But you know what? Instantly when she has the opportunity to play with a friend or even interact with a friend on Zoom, if the friend is quarantining, she'll always take that in a heartbeat, right? She will always, but in the absence of that social interaction, that critical need of relatedness, well, where else is she going to go, right? Like she's looking for relatedness. She's looking for connection. I always encourage parents to interact with whatever it is their kid is supposedly obsessed with. You know, if you ever played Fortnite, you know, a year ago, everybody thought Fortnite was melting all the kids' brains. You know, Fortnite isn't a video game. It's a social network. It's a way to connect with your friends. And I remember when I was a kid, I'd be on the phone for 3 hours a night with my friends. Well, that's what kids are doing today on Fortnite. They're just connecting with each other. They're relating with each other. Now, can it be overdone? Absolutely, it can be overdone. But we need to understand their internal triggers. Hmm. Then the next step, same as for adults, it's about making time for traction. So as long as a child is intentional about that time, about, hey, how much time do you think is good for you to play a video game or to watch YouTube videos or whatever it might be. Of course, you know, little caveat, must be age appropriate, should go without saying, but I need to say it anyway.
17 hours.
Well, not only about the time, but the age appropriateness, right? Like I wouldn't take my child to a library and say she could read any book. Reading is wonderful, but there's a lot of books that a 12-year-old is not ready for. Mm-hmm. So of course you need to be careful around what kind of content your child is interacting with online. It has to be age appropriate. But having that conversation with them, you'd be surprised. You know, I had this conversation with my daughter around how much time do you want to watch videos or play apps? It was nowhere near as much time as I thought. I thought she would say all day. No, you know, when given the choice and putting it on her schedule, it was she wanted 45 minutes. She wanted 2 episodes a day. Okay. So I said, as long as you're responsible for monitoring that time. And we did this, by the way, when she was only 5 years old.
Wow.
And so she had a little timer that she could use to keep track of herself, of her time. Now she actually uses, it's interesting, she uses Amazon Alexa. And she says, Alexa, set a timer for 45 minutes and she'll watch her little episode. I got no problem with that, as long as she knows that she's using that time the way she intended. And I got to back off, right? As much as I want to say something and interrupt her. No. That's the time she planned to watch her show or play a video game. There's no data, not even one study that says that 2 hours or less of extracurricular screen time has any deleterious effects. So as long as she's, you know, mindfully using that time, no problem. I think the third thing, you know, back to the third step, just for adults, the same with children around hacking back external triggers. A big mistake that parents make that is so easy to correct is realizing that, if there's one thing that is pretty much undebatable, is that children need proper rest. In fact, this is another area that parents are hypocrites. We say, you know, of course our kids need a bedtime, but do we have a bedtime?
I do, but I'm old like that.
Awesome. I didn't adopt a bedtime until I wrote Indistractable and realized how important it is to have a bedtime myself. Also to set an example for my daughter. But what we don't realize is that anything that pings or dings or rings in a child's room, not just the cell phone, and of course, not just the computer, the television. I don't know why a child needs a television in their bedroom. For the life of me, I don't know why that's a good idea. Anything that interrupts a child's sleep, even a radio, does not need to be in a child's room. If it beeps, boops, whatever, if it can interrupt their sleep, it should not be in the bedroom. That's how we can hack back those external triggers. Mm-hmm. Teaching your child, by the way, how to disconnect from these things. To say, like, you know, I get this question a lot about, how do I know a child is ready for a particular technology? First step is to ask the manufacturer, right? So if you look at, before you install Facebook, it says minimum age, you know, in the app description, minimum age 13, okay? Why would you let your kid use a product that the manufacturer says do not let them use until a certain age? Oh, but all their friends are using it. So what? You're paying the bill.
And you're the parent.
And you're the parent. Exactly. I don't care what they're doing. And, you know, I mean, we've had this conversation for generations. So if the company itself says, don't let your kid use a product till a certain age, please believe them. Okay. Mm-hmm. But also the test to see if they're really ready for it is, do they know how to turn it off? Right. So if you say, you know, look, we're going to let you have a cell phone, but if you bring it to the dinner table, which is a no phone zone, then we're going to have this conversation. We're going to have to revisit this conversation. If you can't turn on the do not disturb feature while you're doing homework, we're going to have a conversation about that. So this is how we make sure they know how to hack back the external triggers. And then finally, preventing distraction with PACs. This is actually typically the kid's favorite part, because we can use technology to block out technology. And kids tend to love this because it kind of gamifies their ability to stay focused. And so let me give you a good example. There's this wonderful app called Forest, Forest. And basically what it does, it's this app you open up and you dial in how much time you want to do focus work for. Let's say you say 45 minutes or an hour, whatever it is. You push a button that says plant, and then this cute little virtual tree is planted on your screen. Now, if you pick up the phone and do anything with it, the little virtual tree gets chopped down and dies, okay? And you don't want to kill the cute little virtual tree. And of course, if you fulfill your time, then you get to upgrade the tree and decorate the tree. And my daughter loves it. And so basically what that is a pact. It's a pre-commitment device that blocks out the phone for certain times of the day when they need to do homework or, you know, family time, whatever it might be. So that, again, is how we use these four steps with our children to help them become indistractable as well.
That's great. I just want to mention Freedom, because Freedom's actually sponsoring this episode, and they mentioned that they've got a great relationship with you. And I recently did, I chose to block off all distracting websites. And I love the pop-up. It was just like this beautiful green, you know, like empowering statement. And it just was like that perfect little reminder, right? I made a pre-pact to not be, you know, hooked into those distracting websites. And I love that you advocate for using, you know, these free and paid tools to support us. I want to get into talking about our social lives, like the good of engaging our human connections and relationships, which you talk a lot about. Like me, you believe in the importance of doing the necessary work in maintaining and nurturing friendships and to create a healthy network of warm human relationships. And I just want to give a little shout out to our mutual friend, Jillian Richardson, the author of Unlonely Planet, who I recently had on as well. Your family, I believe, has a weekly kibbutz to talk about a serious topic with friends. What are the conditions you feel create quality interactions that help nurture relationship?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, this is such an important issue because, you know, we are going through a loneliness epidemic in this country. I know you're in Canada. I don't know what the stats are in Canada, but in the United States, certainly, you know, we know that experts tell us that loneliness is as detrimental to our health as smoking and obesity.
Yeah.
So it is a very serious problem. And I think part of the reason this has happened, and this isn't a new problem, by the way, this is not something that the internet created or Facebook created. I think Facebook and these social networks are a desperate attempt to regain some of that lost social time. It's because we are desperately lonely that we are looking for connection somewhere. Back to that needs displacement hypothesis that we talked about with kids. If you don't have your needs met offline, you look for them online. And what's happened since the 1990s, there was a book written by Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone that came out in the 1990s that was documenting this phenomenon of since the 1950s, people don't engage in these social activities, right? The civil society that we used to have, the bowling league, the church group, the Kiwanis Club, the charity meeting that every Thursday you know you had to show up for and people would expect you to be there, those are disappearing. Largely, this is because of secularization, that less people are religious now than they used to be. And so they are not going to the church or the synagogue or the mosque on a regular basis, and they're not expected to. They don't have that social bond. And I think that has caused some really deleterious consequences. And look, I'm not very religious. I'm not telling people to go necessarily, you know, go against their moral beliefs just for the community. But I would say that we must, for our physical and mental well-being, we must find that community somewhere. And we must keep that time sacred. We have to protect that time. I think if there is one silver lining to the corona crisis, it's that people are booking time on their schedule for these Zoom meetings with their loved ones. Because, you know, at least in my family, I know I've spoken to many of my friends have observed the same phenomenon. When it came to our close friends, we would say, all right, we'll see you when we see you. Or our family members, okay, I'll call you from time to time. But because of the nature of these Zoom calls, right, that we have to check in, whether FaceTime or Zoom or whatever, we have to put that on our calendars. So in my family, it's every Saturday we see our family. We all get together in three different time zones on Zoom, and it's in our calendars. And I'm looking forward, I hope that even after Corona, that people keep that time on their calendar and keep it sacred for those relationships. Just like you would protect a business meeting with a VIP, I think we should also keep that time for our closest relationships as well.
Do you think part of it, like tied into the secularization, do you think it's also the shift of thinking of ourselves as citizens to thinking of ourselves as consumers that's made that shift in terms of social commitments and being engaged in more social communities and, you know, active citizenism? That's not a word. Citizenship. Yes.
You know, I think there's probably a lot, there's a lot of factors going on. I think part of it is that we, you know, the fact that we can entertain ourselves by ourselves is a relatively new phenomenon, right? Starting with mass media, starting with, you know, the printing of books, right? Once it wasn't just rich people who had books, but anyone could read a book, that led to more social isolation. And then, of course, you get the radio and then you get the television. And of course, now with the internet, the time that you spend by yourself is a lot less boring. It doesn't mean you're not lonely. You're still lonely. but at least you're not as bored. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, you know, on a Friday night, it was really boring hanging out at home. You wanted to go to the bowling league, right, to get, you know, some kind of entertainment. And so I think we need to actively fight that and find ways to realize that this is why we feel lonely, right? This is why we're desperate for hiring a therapist or for, you know, going on social media or finding some way to fill that hole. The hole we're missing is friends, right? Mm-hmm. Is knowing that we understand people and that people understand us. That is a fundamental human need that we are desperately looking for. And I think the way to fill that need is not just, you know, party all the time, right? That's not what I'm talking about. It's about consistent interaction. Mm-hmm. It's the consistency that makes for these lifelong friendships that give us that psychological nourishment that I think many of us are missing.
Two things about that. I think, like many people, I'm kind of fascinated by Scandinavia and how they often rank right highest or very high on the World Happiness Report year after year after year. And I think I had this incredible realization where I read this study about how the average, you know, person in Scandinavia is a member of like 4 to 6 social groups. So that, you know, on every Thursday, they're going to knitting club and every Friday they're at, you know, X club. And that whole decision-making fatigue around what should I do tonight? What should I not do tonight? It's sort of like those decisions have been made and they're going out on a regular basis to be in community. And I think that that is something that we can, you know, start to model in our own lives in terms of building traction, in terms of building traction in human connection and, yeah, building relationship, like having those commitments built in your calendar and, you know, having integrity. Like we started the conversation today talking about integrity with ourselves, right? Having integrity with ourselves and with other people, those pacts you're talking about.
Absolutely. And I think it goes back to the whole theme of your podcast around the joy of missing out, like knowing that you don't have FOMO when you know that there's a joy in missing that, because in order to miss that, you have this other time planned. Okay. I'm not going to go out spontaneously right now because I said I was going to do something else. I said I was going to go to the gym. I said I was going to finish that report. I said I was going to play with my kids, and I'm not going to feel bad about it because I know on my calendar is time for friends, right? I have that booked. I think part of the reason that so many people feel constant FOMO is that they don't know that the time is coming, that there's a time and a place for socialization, right? Mm. So they said they're going to work out. They said they're going to spend time with their kids. They said they're going to do whatever they're going to do. But then they get this offer to go out with a friend or to, you know, have drinks with a buddy. And it's so rare that they can't help but jump at it. And then they actually don't do what they said they're going to do. Of course, going out with your buddy is a wonderful thing, but not if you promised your kids you were going to play with them.
Right.
Not if you said to your spouse that you're going to go on a date day. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's really about having that regular interaction. And so I talk about different strategies, like, for example, you mentioned the kibbutz, you know, these regular interactions that I have with my friends. Say, this is on the calendar in perpetuity. We're going to get together. You know, you're going to see me. And this is how we maintain those friendships that, you know, most friendships, statistically, friendships, if you look at why friendships end, most friendships don't end because two people got in a fight and said, we don't want to be friends anymore. The vast majority of friendships starve to death. They just kind of, we just lost touch. And oh, it's been so long and I'm not going to call her because, you know, it's been so long. We'd have to catch up. It's kind of awkward now that we haven't talked. So, whatever. Mm. That's why friendships die. They starve to death.
Oh, man, we could talk so much about all the things that we starve in our lives, not just friendships. I'm mindful of our time, Nir, and I'm so grateful you've been with me. I would love to just wrap up with hearing about some of the books and thinkers or programs that are influencing your thinking right now on this topic.
Oh, wow. I spent the 5 years kind of immersed in this topic, and there were so many people who influenced my thinking. B.J. Fogg, Robert Bandura, Robert Sapolsky, Jonathan Haidt, the list goes on and on and on. There's a lot of people I have to thank, and you can see all the acknowledgments in my, I know I'm missing a ton of people. I've been very fortunate to have access to some amazing thinkers out there.
And what are you just curious about right now? What's kind of sparking your interest or curiosity right now?
Oh, there's all kinds of things. I think recently I've been getting into the science of motivation. Mm-hmm. Around, you know, why are some people able to sustain the desire, the energy to do something, while other things, other people and with certain tasks, it's a lot of effort. It's a lot of heavy lifting to motivate ourselves to do something, particularly in the workplace context. I'm really curious about, can you engineer the type of job that someone would love to do, even when the work kind of sucks? Mm. I think a lot of people, this is kind of a harsh term, so I don't talk about it much, but so I'm still struggling with it. So if this is offensive, please forgive me, but it's something I struggle with. I think there are a lot of wage slaves out there, mm-hmm. right? That people who are working for no other reason but the money. And it's hard to call that anything but slavery. Like, I think, you know, if we look 100 years from now and we look back at 2020, I have a feeling there'll be a lot, there has to be. Like, if we look back in 1920, there's all kinds of things that people did in 1920 that we thought were ridiculous, that we can't imagine. Of course, you know, like the way people thought about other races, unconscionable, the sexism. There's all kinds of disparities that today we think are crazy. And very immoral. And I think in 100 years, there will be lots of things that we look back and think are completely immoral. And I think one of those things is wage slavery, that how can it be that if somebody is doing a job, like, well, in 100 years, I think we will look back and say, you know, there used to be an age that I remember grandchildren or great-grandchildren, that there was a time when if you didn't work, you were going to starve. Mm-hmm. Like, you wouldn't have healthcare. At least in America, and you wouldn't be able to feed your family, and you were going to starve. like that was okay. And so that's been something that's been occupying my brain. Now I don't know the answer. You know, people are floating around UBI, mm-hmm. you know, universal basic income, and various ideas. So that's something. Again, I don't have a fully formed answer, but you asked, what am I thinking about? So I don't have any answers yet.
That's okay. No, I'm just always curious about books and, you know, influences on people's lives. And sometimes those can be like BJ Fogg, for example, obviously has been, you know, has informed a lot of your writing and thinking. But sometimes we somehow discover something unexpected. Like, I'm reading a book right now called The Wander Society. And it's like this interesting blend between reality. Like, you don't really know if it's fiction or nonfiction. And it's very playful. And it's all about this theme of being indistractable or being distracted and just wandering through the world, attentive to what you see around yourself. And it's kind of this manifesto, but reclaiming wandering.
I'll write it down. I kind of,
yeah,
you recommend
it's by Carrie Smith. Yeah, I recommend it. It's super weird. And it's got lots of art and visuals. And I discovered it because I was doing a talk at Fireside Conference. And this girl that was at my talk came up and she had it in her hand. And I was curious about it and opened it up and thought it was magical. And anyways, sometimes we just stumble upon things that are quite exciting and interesting.
I'll check it out. I'll put it on my Kindle and start reading it. That sounds great.
Well, thank you, Nir, so much. It must be late there.
Yes, it's 9:30 p.m. over here.
I'll let you head on to your bedtime routine. Near and Far is where people can find you. Is that correct?
That's right. Near and Far. Near is spelled like my first name, so that's nirandfar.com. And I should mention as well that there is an 80-page workbook that you can download there for free. We didn't fit it into the final edition of the book because it got too fat, so we decided to make it available for free. Anyone can grab that at nirandfar.com. And the book, again, is called Indistractable: How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life.
Amazing. And we'll, of course, link to all of those in the show notes. Thanks again, Nir.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the JomoCast. Learn more about our guests in the show notes and by visiting JomoCast.com. And remember to subscribe to the JomoCast to be the first to hear our latest episodes. This podcast is made possible by listeners just like you. If you're interested in helping us keep these raw, vulnerable conversations going, leave us a 5-star review or share today's podcast with your friends. I hope the rest of your day brings you peace, and that you embrace the joy of missing out.